Asal, welcome to the show. How are you?
You know, as well as can be with everything that's happening in this world. But thank you for having me and for, you know, having this platform for these discussions.
Oh, it's such an honor. And, you know, I first heard of your book, which is going to be published at the time of the airing of this. It will already be published, but it's called Don't Say Palestine: How the Media Manufactured Consent for Genocide. And I heard that you were going to be publishing this, and I said, okay, I got to take a look at this and also interview you. So I'm really excited about this because this is a topic that is very dear to my heart, and I can tell it is for you as well. And maybe let me start there. How did you get into this whole situation with researching media in relation to Palestine?
You know, my sort of background into being interested in Palestine more broadly started when I was very young. It was as an undergraduate student in the early 2000s. I think for a lot of people of my generation, the 9/11, the war on terror, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, and if you're looking at Palestine specifically, the Second Intifada, which was also happening in that period, like all of those events coalescing really helped shape a political outlook that was fundamentally just anti-war and really looked at U.S. foreign policy. I say this as from an American point of view, that looked at, you know, the U.S. role in what was happening in the region. And, you know, you can see how as a young person, you'd be drawn to the story of Palestine, the idea of these people who have been occupied, despite all things, remaining resilient, despite all obstacles. And sort of when you started to really look at it, you realize the way that the story has been told in the Western world is really the opposite of what is happening. Because in some ways, it's an inversion where Israel is presented as a victim and Palestinians are presented as terrorists and aggressors. And then when you actually look at the history, you realize that Palestinians are an indigenous population that have been occupied, and Israel is a settler colony that has, you know, that has terrorized the civilian population literally for decades. So that was my interest specifically in understanding Palestine. And, you know, that's what made me want to study the region further, eventually getting a PhD in history in the modern Middle East. And the part where media plays into it is when you study the Middle East, I mean, one of the most important texts that all of us will read is Edward Said's Orientalism. And this idea of the entire way that the region has been depicted through the academy, through popular culture, through art. And that made me very interested in understanding narratives, how stories are told. In our modern society, to my mind at least, the most important storyteller is the news media. Because most people, you know, if you're looking at mass consumption of the public, most people are not going to be reading a lot of books on these topics. They're not, you know, everybody has their own jobs and specialties and things that they're working on. And so everyone's not going to become a historian of the Middle East. That's not the extent that their education is going to go on this particular topic. And so where do we get most of our information? Well, we get it through political discourse. We get it through, you know, popular culture. But information and knowledge production really happens at the media level for the mass public. So I've always been interested in the way that the story is told because that's how people understand it. And what we've seen in the last 3 years is when they're allowed to see things with their own eyes, their opinions dramatically shift.
Yeah, I can testify to that myself. I mean, look, I grew up in Israel and also occupied Palestine, son of Christian Zionist missionaries in Jerusalem as well. And so we were kind of fed a lot of that propaganda. I was fed a lot of misinformation, I would say, and actually told very little about the Palestinians. Of course, I heard about Arabs and conflict with Arabs, but there wasn't really an honest telling of the history here and what was going on at the time when I was living there. And certainly there isn't an honest telling of what's going on now. And I had to kind of work my way out of that propaganda by going to not traditional media, but rather social media, and being confronted with the reality of what's taking place. And so this topic is important to me because I feel that I myself was duped by a lot of this propaganda that you have, especially in the media. And so what you do in the book is you are showing how biased the media is, and as you say, manufacturing consent for genocide. And what I love that you do is you go to the headlines and you correct the headlines. In fact, you have a prologue that starts out, "Why I correct headlines." So maybe explain that. Why do you do that?
Well, first, I want to say that I think your personal story is fascinating. You know, I mean, and it's within the context of this conversation, it's such an important example of exactly what I was talking about. You know, it's, I think a lot of times when we think about public opinion, whether it's driven by, you know, if there is a bias and whether it's driven by, you know, sort of racialized ideas of, you know, Arabs and Muslims are bad, or just these geopolitical, I'll call them truths in quotation marks, because they become, you know, there's certain things that are repeated so often in Western society that we believe them to be truths. And I love hearing that you were able to go through a process of just, you know, learning the truth and then drawing your own conclusions. And I think very often when people are exposed to that truth, then they reach the same conclusion that you did, right? You've been duped by the sort of way that the story has been told this entire time. And that's ultimately what we're seeking, just truth. People can draw their own conclusions. What I and so many others are asking for is that this, that it be told honestly. And that's not what we have seen. So you asked about, you know, the prologue and why I focus on headlines or correct headlines. And it's because headlines are often the only thing that people read. I mean, we have all sorts of, you know, statistics that say, you know, how often do people, when you're, especially when you're scrolling online, how often do people actually click on the article and read it? Not very often. You're usually just scrolling. I mean, this is what, this is the way that we consume information. The public consumes information passively, unless you're really trying, unless you really want to go deeper. It's passive consumption of information. And so it's this peripheral way of taking in information that's so important. That's precisely what a headline is. The headline frames the story. It's the first thing that sums up what the story is about. And if you were to read, for instance, a headline every single day that said, "Israel kills Palestinian child," which would be accurate because Israel is killing a Palestinian child on average every day, that would become entrenched in people's minds. That would become part of, like, unconsciously, it would be something that people recognize because they would read it over and over and over again. But they don't. Instead, they read these convoluted headlines. There's, you know, Israel is missing or omitted from the text. It's not really clear who the victims are. It's not really clear who, you know, is the agent of their killing. And in that way, you can create this vague sort of language that allows people to maintain that narrative of the status quo, that again, Israel is always the perpetual victim and Palestinians are always the aggressors, when in fact, if you were to be honest, it's the other way around. Because this, if you break it down to its simplest terms, Palestinians are an occupied people. Israel is the occupier. It's not complicated. People make it complicated, but it's not complicated. It's very, very simple in that sense. But that somehow is not the way that most, you know, most Americans or people in the Western world understand it. And that is because of the way that they're consuming passively this information through, whether it's, you know, whether it's headlines, whether it's, you know, listening to mainstream cable news and the language that the anchors use or the ticker at the bottom of it. All of those things are the ways that we're getting information in a very sort of everyday sense.
I've had this same observation, but on a much smaller level. I've seen a lot of people post malicious and false headlines about me, spreading propaganda. And I'll notice that no matter how many times I correct the narrative, people just see, they just go with what they see in a headline. And so the details, the nuance, the qualifications, all of that information is usually lost. And all they see is just the headline. And I think that's certainly true in this case of this conflict with Israel and Palestine. One of the headlines that you pointed to in the book is one that said, "Lives ended in Gaza." Lives ended in Gaza. That's one way to put it, right?
Yeah.
And it obviously avoids, you know, the question of, well, who ended the lives? And what was this, a illicit ending of the lives, or is this something that was criminal in nature? You know, they're avoiding all of that. And I would think that after a long period of time being bombarded with headlines that are very misleading like this, it creates an impression. Whereas if they were saying Israel murdered Palestinians in Gaza, that would lead to a different outcome if that was something that people were just being hammered with. And so obviously this is intentional. This is manufactured, as you say. And
I'm sorry, just to point out, because it is described that way the other way around.
What do you mean?
That's the interesting thing. It's not that that language, for instance, like the word massacre or murder, will be applied to Israelis if they're Israeli victims, but it won't be applied to Palestinians.
And you point that out also with, I think, the Russia and Ukraine conflict as well, right?
Exactly. So it's not that the language, it's not that they don't have this language. That's an important part to point out too, because what media outlets will argue is that they're being neutral. Oh, we're being neutral. But you're not neutral, because you'll use the language of war crimes when you're describing Russia. You'll use the language of lies and deception when you're describing Vladimir Putin. You'll use the language of massacre and murder when you're talking about Israeli victims. But you do not apply the same standards to Palestinians. I mean, that double standard breaks down to me simply to the dehumanization of one population. And so it's not that the language is not available, it's that they're not using it. And the example you gave, by the way, it's from the New York Times. It was in, I think it was February, late February, early March of 2024, when the death toll in Gaza had reached the 30,000 threshold. And what was interesting about that particular headline is two things. Number one, no one talks like that. No one says lives ended. Like that. It's sometimes when you look at the language that they use, I'm confused, because I'm like, this is not how people write. This is not how people speak. Like, this is not proper English. Nobody talks this way and yet this is the kind of language, the convoluted language you'll see in a lot of these headlines. The other point that's really important about that particular headline is around the same time, there was polling in the US where half of Americans couldn't say if more Palestinians had been killed by that point versus Israelis. And the number is not even remotely close. I mean, Israelis, essentially, if you're looking at it within the time frame of October 7th, if that's the time frame we're taking, then the numbers were 1,200 versus 30,000. They're not even close. We're looking at almost 30 times more people having been killed amongst Palestinians. So how do you explain that? How do you explain that the public of a country that is, you know, directly supporting this, that is funding it, that is using its own tax dollars in the order of billions of dollars, that is using its weapons, all of its diplomatic power, it's in the news every day. How does this public not know this very, very basic fact? Think about the headlines, because you just wrote lives ended in Gaza. How are people supposed to know when this is the way that you frame it? So I thought it was very interesting that that headline came out at a similar time as that polling.
And okay, so very clearly these headlines, they're intentional, because as you note, they could say massacre, they could say murder when it comes to Palestinians, but whenever it comes to Israelis, they soften the language. And so I guess one of my questions is, since we're seeing this is so pervasive in the media, I mean, you give screenshots from everything, and by the way, I think it's genius that you're showing the screenshots in the book. I love that, because I think people need to see that visually. This is all of the news outlets that you're showing are complicit in this. So I guess my question is, who's giving the command to do this? I mean, this is obviously coordinated, so who's controlling that?
You know, there's different, I think, influences that get this kind of landscape. When you look at the media landscape, I don't think it's the consequence of one feature. It's the consequence of many features. And that's why I said the media doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's not just the media that's doing it on its own. It's getting language from our politicians. That's one of the most important points. There's a reason why I spend an entire chapter talking about the Biden admin, because it's the people in power that set the tone in language. You know, as soon as, for instance, President Biden casts doubt, right, undermines, essentially dehumanizes Palestinians by saying he doesn't trust the death toll numbers, you see all of these outlets adopt the language of Hamas-run health ministry in order to cast doubt on the death toll numbers. And so they're getting a lot of their cues from official statements of both the Israeli government and their own governments in the Western world, whether it's the UK, whether it's the US, whether it's Canada, wherever this, the media is, these major institutions. And that's the problem. That's the whole thing that I'm pointing out is, well, if you're a free media, if you're a free press, then you're not supposed to be taking talking points from governments. You're supposed to be holding governments accountable. Like the most important, one of the most important pillars of a democratic society is the free press. It's one of the checks and balances. It's one of the things that keeps power accountable. And if it's just repeating and regurgitating whatever the governments are saying, then it's not doing its job, you know, at least in theory, if you believe that that's what their actual fundamental role within a society is. So when you think about where is this, you know, who's controlling what's happening, then you have within each institution, if you go back, you know, the subtitle of the book, Manufacturing Consent for Genocide, I'm using the language of the original book title, Manufacturing Consent from 1988, by Herman and Chomsky, where they look at the media's role as not a free press, but they argue it's a propaganda wing, right? It's the propaganda machine of elites and governments, essentially. And part of the argument is, well, because they're incentivized. They're incentivized because this is corporate media, there's money involved, so they're incentivized through economic interest and access. If you are a outlet that is very, very critical of the government, you might not get access to interviewing the president or interviewing, you know, Israeli ministers or interviewing people who are in positions of power. And so there's those things that influence the way that the media operates. Then there's very direct things that we've seen. You know, like we see, for instance, a memo leaked from the New York Times. Now, I don't know who wrote the memo, but there's a memo that's coming obviously from higher up that's instructing reporters on words and language not to use, to avoid. Now, what are those words? Avoid saying Palestine. Avoid, don't use genocide, ethnic cleansing, refugee camp, all the things that would actually describe what's happening. Now, in my mind, once there's a memo that says don't use these words, that's plainly censorship. That's plainly censorship. That's not, you know, in any other situation, in any other country in the world, we would say that's censorship. So it's censorship when it's happening here as well. There are, you know, conflicts of interest within some of these institutions. Mondelweiss had a great dossier and piece where they wrote about conflicts of interest within the New York Times. And for instance, people who are writing about Israel-Palestine, who have either served in the Israeli military, have children serving in the Israeli military, or people within the executive, executive levels of the organization that have other conflicts of interest because they serve on boards or in organizations that have ties to Israel. So in that sense, you know, how often do we see Palestinians covering Palestine in US media? They would call, you know, oftentimes you don't see that. There are no Palestinians writing about it. And yet you can serve in the Israeli military and still write about Israel. And this is called neutrality. So there's all sorts of pieces that influence the way that this sort of machine operates. I don't want to simplify it as this is how the control scheme works. But ultimately, and then you have, sorry, I should have mentioned this too. Then you also have what are called like media watchdogs, groups like Camera or Honest Reporting, who have been around for decades and pressure newsrooms to use particular kinds of language. Or if anything is critical of Israel, they will call it anti-Semitic, which brings pressure onto the newsrooms to use particular language or soften their language when they're talking about Israel. And we see that happening in its most extreme form today, right? We see Congress passing bills that say if American students use their constitutional rights of free speech and protest to boycott Israel, a foreign country, then their American universities will not get funding. That's insane. I don't know how else to describe it. Like, we live, at least nominally, in a democratic country, and our students and our universities are being penalized for our students using their constitutional rights because they're criticizing a foreign country. By the way, you can criticize the U.S. government. You can criticize the U.S. government and your university won't lose funding, but you can't criticize a foreign government. So you're seeing the space close more and more and more. And that's why I say, when you ask, you know, where is it coming from? It's coming from everywhere. It is a full-scale attempt to control a narrative because they could see it getting away from them. And they is the powerful, the elites, the people who want to maintain the status quo as it is, who want to be able to send billions of dollars in military aid to Israel without anybody questioning it, who want to be able to send weapons to Israel without anybody questioning it. And over the last 3 years, a lot of people have been questioning it. And that's why you see this doubling down. And instead of responding to the criticisms that people have, at least within the political realm, there is more and more repression of free speech. And where the media is concerned, they just don't change their tone, right? If the media was being neutral today, they would call it a genocide. That's what neutral is. Calling it what it is neutral. Refusing to call it a genocide when every major international institution and human rights groups, including those in Israel, have concluded that Israel is committing genocide, is the definition of partiality.
I want to also touch on that question of genocide, but let me first ask this. You mentioned a memo there. Which news outlets did that go to?
That was the New York Times.
New York Times. And it was just specific to them.
It was specific to the New York Times, but something else to take into account is there were also, you know, resignations within other major outlets like the BBC and Reuters and CNN. People within, you know, there were letters of sort of like protest and pressure within all of those institutions as well, where the actual journalists were telling the public, there is a very clear bias in the way this we can present information. Like, there is a lot of pressure within these newsrooms not to use certain language or not to pursue certain news stories, especially when those news stories are not confirmed by Israel, which is so ridiculous, right? You have to wait. Palestinian journalists on the ground, Palestinian aid workers are telling you what's happening, but they're not believed, right? So the story is not, I'll give you an example, actually, like a concrete example. I believe it was spring of last year. There's so many, you know, horrific stories. It's hard sometimes to remember the exact timeline. There was the story of 15 Palestinian medics who were found in mass graves, buried, along with their vehicles crushed. And this obviously was a huge story because this is a massive war crime to have targeted and killed paramedics, then to try to cover it up by burying their bodies in a mass grave and crushing the evidence, which is their ambulances. Now, Palestinians were reporting this for at least a week. There were many days in which if you were following Palestinian journalists and Palestinian media, you knew that this is what was happening because they kept saying these medics have been massacred. They've gone missing. They've clearly been massacred by the Israeli military. No Western media picked it up. Then the UN posted that they had found the mass grave. And once it was this kind of an institution, then suddenly the story started to come out. So why don't we trust Palestinian sources? We don't trust the actual victims. We talk about trusting victims, and yet Palestinians who are the victims are not trusted in this situation. So when you look at the way that the media sort of responds to these things, they just double down on the same kind of like dehumanization and double standards that government institutions use and other like popular culture and media use as well. But in terms of the broad landscape, like that memo was for the New York Times, but there's clearly this pattern because you're hearing it from the reporters working at these institutions themselves.
I want to ask you about the narrative that the media uses about Palestinians that you say in the book is a misleading narrative. And maybe an example of this is what you're talking about here when it comes to journalists. I think one of the reasons why they're saying, well, we don't care what Palestinian journalists are saying is because they're affiliated with Hamas and therefore they're terrorists. And so they dismiss anything that they have to say. Can you maybe talk about that?
Sure. Well, here's the thing is, if Hamas is the governing body in Gaza, that means everything, right? So if you're a civil force, if you, any institution in Gaza, if it's educational, if it's anything having to do with, you know, the governance of this population will be related to Hamas. That's not, that doesn't make them violent. That doesn't make them militants. That doesn't make them fighters. That just means that this is the governing body. But what happens is by using that kind of framing, the intention is to say, well, everybody, that means they're all terrorists because this is a designated terrorist organization. Now, here's the problem with the general framing, right? The Hamas is sort of used as this scapegoat. That's the way of getting away with everything. You say, well, the problem is Hamas. Except for the fact that if you actually look at the history, the occupation predates Hamas by decades. Hamas is a consequence of occupation. And you see the same thing, for instance, in the case of Lebanon. They'll talk about Hezbollah the same way. Well, the problem is Hezbollah. Well, actually, Hezbollah was a direct response to Israeli occupation and invasion of Lebanon in the 1980s. So again, the problem with the way that we try to understand the narrative is by problematizing one side, which typically is the side that's been occupied and is the victim, because once they resist that occupation, they become the bad guy. But the whole point of it is because that's the sort of simplistic caricature, you know, the caricature or the dichotomy is that Israel, by its very nature, is always the good guy. So it doesn't matter what they're doing. They can even commit genocide. They're still, it's still justified. It's a self-defense. Israeli violence is benevolent violence, no matter what they do. And on the other hand, if Palestinians resist that very violence, if Palestinians resist Israeli occupiers that are terrorizing them on a daily basis, if they resist pogroms in the occupied West Bank, if they resist apartheid, if they do anything to resist these things, they are called terrorists. The other aspect of it that I think is really important, because you hear this kind of talking point is, well, if they just wouldn't use violence, it would be different. Except for the fact that Palestinians have tried every avenue possible. They've tried peaceful protests. They've tried international law. I mean, the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, actually said at one point that the PA's, the Palestinian Authority's attempt to use the international courts or international law is the same thing as what Hamas is doing. So they're telling you outright that even trying to use international, what happens when, you know, the ICC, if you try to use the ICC in order to hold Israeli officials accountable, the ICC is the problem, right? It's, again, it's not Israeli officials and the fact that they're committing war crimes. The problem is the ICC. If the UN comes out with a report that says, you know, Israel is targeting children, the problem is not Israel targeting children. The problem is the UN. So you see this constant pattern. The problem is never Israel. And so that tells you the sort of inherent illogic that we're dealing with. The labels that are given have nothing to do with the actions. It's simply the actors. If Palestinians use violence, that violence is bad no matter what, even if it's violence and resistance, even if it is actually self-defense, because only Israel has the right to, quote, self-defense, except for the fact that occupiers aren't defending themselves. It's the occupied that are defending themselves. And we understand this in other scenarios. You know, we understand this idea that if you are attacked, or if you are occupied, if your home is stolen, if your family is attacked, that you have the right to defend yourself, but not if you're Palestinian.
Yeah, and I think it kind of goes back to the narrative that somehow the Zionists are entitled to the land. And maybe it ties into some of the biblical propaganda that's very, very popular in the Western mind. Let me ask you about the Biden administration, because you spent a fair amount in the book talking about how the Biden administration influenced the narrative on Gaza. And I want to hear more about that. And by the way, I also want to hear, is the Trump administration any better or worse?
I think it's interesting that you phrase it that way, because, you know, I've gotten some criticism for, why don't you criticize the Trump administration as much as you did the Biden admin? And my first response to that is because the genocide happened under the Biden admin. Trump inherited a genocide. Once he takes office, Gaza is already destroyed. Starvation has already been normalized as a tool of warcraft. A record number of journalists have been killed. A record number of aid workers have been killed. All of these things happen under the Biden admin. So that's the number one reason, is this is the responsibility of the administration that actually allowed it to happen. The other is the fact that the Trump administration doesn't really use the language of international law. You know, they're not sort of like hiding the fact that there is a massive double standard across the board. They don't use these institutions in the same way. They don't use the same language. In fact, Joe Biden himself, because remember, there's a sandwiching of Trump administrations, and in the middle you have the Biden admin. When President Biden begins his administration, his first message to the international community, I think it was in February of 2021, was America is back. This is the language he used himself. Now, what did he mean by America is back? His entire point was that that President Trump, and under his administration, the U.S. had lost its position as a world leader, that we had, you know, sort of spurned international law and institutions, our allies, all of the traditional relationships and institutional mechanisms that created what we call the international rules-based order, was undermined by the Trump administration. And Biden was here to set the record straight and to fix it. He was going to fix all of that. And the first sort of test of that was Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And you saw the Biden admin galvanize and you know, unite Europe and much of, not much of the world, but mostly the Western world, at least Europe, to put immediately sanctions on Russia, vilify Russia, say that, you know, it took the Biden admin about 10 to 14 days to say that Russia was committing war crimes. Biden, within 1 month of the invasion of Ukraine, within 1 month, called it a genocide. Let's just keep that in mind for a minute, that he called Russia's actions in Ukraine a genocide. 15 months of overseeing genocide in Gaza, that language was never used. The Biden admin could not conclude one war crime was committed by Israel the entire time, arguing that it was difficult to assess when the conflict was ongoing. And yet they could do it in the case of Russia. So what Biden did is he really gave you the hypocrisy right there, because he consistently used a double standard when it was applied to Russia versus when it was applied to Israel. The Trump admin, I mean, you see the way the president treats Russia. It's not the same as his predecessor. And so it is, while the continuity of a lot of these policies have been maintained under this administration, all of it was sort of, especially in terms of Gaza, began with the Biden admin. And the last point I'll make on this particularly is Biden paved the way for Trump to allow all of these things to happen. Once it was normalized, why would this administration step in and do anything different? Why would they think that, you know, Israel assassinating or targeting journalists is a crime when the Biden admin didn't treat it as such? Why would they say it's a genocide when the Biden admin didn't treat it as such? And I think the worst part about it is that under the Biden administration, under a Democrat-led government that uses liberal language, they allowed this to happen. And I think that's a little bit different, right? Because again, the language that's used, I mean, we have in this administration currently sort of overtly racist language that is used against domestic population, against immigrants, against all sorts of groups. That's not the kind of language that the Biden admin utilized. And yet when it came to Palestinians, dehumanizing them and allowing them to be slaughtered en masse was somehow okay. So I think the focus on the Biden admin more than anything else is because the Gaza genocide does not happen without Joe Biden.
I'm also curious, where was the international community in all of this? Why wasn't there and hasn't there been accountability from the international community? I mean, why haven't they just said, you know what, we're going to stop dealing with Israel, we're going to put sanctions on them? I mean, what's going on there?
That's a great question. It's one of the questions I try to raise in the book. I mean, one of the things that I hope that the book elicits more than anything else, or provokes at least, is conversation and debate and discussion. Because, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I can singularly answer all of these questions, like what should an international system look like, or what does accountability look like? Those are questions that or what is the purpose of a free press? Like, these are huge questions that we have to tackle and grapple with as a society. It's more about saying, this is what we've been told. Like, we've been told that we have a free press and it's a pillar of democracy, but do we have a free press? Is it operating that way? This is the question. We have been told that there's something called an international rules-based system, but do we have that? Is that actually how it operates in reality? And I think there's certain things that were inherently obviously flawed about the international system. If you think about it, it was a system that was created in the wake of World War II. The fact that you have permanent members, right, the five permanent members, creates an imbalance of power, which is something the United States has repeatedly wielded, right? Why does the international community fail? Well, the international community, if you actually think about it as, you know, the vast majority of the world, there's a consensus amongst the international community. The vast majority of the international community recognizes the state of Palestine. The vast majority of the international community recognizes that Israel is committing a genocide. They pushed for, the United Nations pushed for ceasefires starting in 2023, but the United States repeatedly vetoed them, using their disproportionate power within that institution to really thwart its ability to do anything. So the problem with these institutions is their mechanisms to enforce things. So, you know, even when I think it was in spring of 2024, because there was growing pressure. Remember, 2024 was an election year, and there was a lot of pressure. You had campus protests in universities. You had the uncommitted movement. You had election-related events, whether it was Biden or later Harris, that were disrupted by protesters, specifically about Gaza. So there was all this pressure growing, and finally there was one resolution that the Biden admin abstained from voting on. They didn't vote for it, but they didn't veto it. And they did a very interesting thing when people were like, oh, so Israel will have to implement the ceasefire now because the resolution passed. The language of, whether it was the White House spokesperson, John Kirby, or the State Department spokesperson, Matthew Miller, the language of it was, well, this is a non-binding resolution, which makes no sense. So what's the point of it then? I mean, that was actually a question that was raised in the State Department briefing, right? Because the question was then, what is the point of the United Nations? So it's actually the most powerful countries in the world, like the United States, even though we tout the idea of an international rules-based system, that undermines it, that has helped to erode that very system. And it's never worked maybe well or perfectly, certainly not, but it's not necessarily even worked well. I mean, if you go back to the 2003 US invasion of Iraq, it was completely illegal. Iraq is a sovereign country. We just decided to go to war with them. It wasn't in self-defense. You know, this language of preemptive strikes, that's not the whole point of international law, is that sovereign nations and borders are supposed to be protected, but we didn't abide by any of that. It's just that Gaza brought all of the hypocrisies, all of the flaws, all of the cracks, right? There were cracks in the system that people could see, but those cracks finally gave and they shattered. And there's just nothing left of it. And so the international system failed because it was inherently flawed from its very beginning. And what we have to start thinking about as an international community is, what is the system or institution? Either how do we reform it, or how do we create something new in its wake that actually does the things that these institutions are supposed to do? Namely, and most importantly, or I should say, at the bare minimum, prevent a genocide, which they failed to do.
You speak of the so-called ceasefire that, of course, has been ongoing, which, interestingly enough, I think Israel has murdered more civilians since the ceasefire than civilians were killed on October 7th. But why do you speak of a so-called ceasefire? Is it because of that? Is it because they're still killing Palestinians?
Well, if an Israeli child was being killed every day, would anybody call it a ceasefire? Of course not. It would never be called a ceasefire. And yet, Israel is killing on, and I'm not even mentioning Palestinian men and women who are also being killed. You know, like the Palestinian men and women are being killed in amongst these children that are being killed as well. I think the reason we focus so much on children, A, I think it's because obviously there's a visceral response as human beings that we have to children being harmed. As adults, we feel like we're their protectors. And so when we see, I mean, children being slaughtered en masse, there's, it causes, I think, almost any person, a reaction. Not everyone, of course, but in most people, it causes a reaction. But also because it is a lot harder to justify kids, right? Palestinian men are essentially treated as, like, when you look at the numbers that Israel gives for how many terrorists they've killed, that's basically if every man is considered a terrorist just because they are male. That's how the numbers break down. So Palestinian men are just automatically treated as though they are not human beings with any rights whatsoever. When it's adults that are being killed, they can make those types of excuses. They were targeting militants. But when you see 100 children killed in one day, it's a lot harder to make that kind of argument. So that's why I emphasize the fact that every single day there's a child being killed. I mean, the meaning of the word ceasefire is completely gone. If Israel can carry out attacks on a daily basis, and so they're not ceased, there's no ceasing of the firing, and they can kill people on a daily basis, that's not a ceasefire. What it does instead is it creates cover for Western media outlets to basically stop talking about it, or to report it much, much less, or report it under the banner of a ceasefire. But there is no real ceasefire, and that's not just the case in Gaza. But you can also see it in the way that Lebanon has been treated over and over again, where Israel is involved. Again, Israel is occupying Lebanon, but it's called a ceasefire. Israel carries out demolitions and is still destroying villages and homes in Lebanon, but it's called a ceasefire. It would not be called that if it was happening in reverse. If Israel was being attacked, if homes were being destroyed, if entire villages were being wiped off the map, that is not a ceasefire. But as long as the victims are not Israeli, it's still considered a ceasefire. And that sort of tells you the notion of which lives matter and which lives don't. And the what all of that kind of points to is another talking point that was used after October 7th. You know, it was, you know, there was a ceasefire on October 6th. You've heard people like Hillary Clinton and many other officials use this kind of language. There was a ceasefire on October 6th. Because when people were pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza, that was their response. Well, there was a ceasefire on October 6th. And then look what Hamas did. Except if you're Palestinian, there was not a ceasefire on October 6th. Because on October 6th, 2023, if you were Palestinian, you were living under occupation, you were living in apartheid, you were living under blockade. 2023, before October 7th, 2023 was already one of the deadliest years on record for Palestinian children in the West Bank, not even in Gaza, in the West Bank. So to say that there was a ceasefire on October 6th is to say that none of those lives matter because they don't count. They are not victims. Again, Israeli violence is not violence. So, I don't know how else to describe it besides gaslighting. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just they're trying to tell us not to believe our own eyes, not to believe our own, you know, ears, not to have the most basic comprehension of ideas. Like I'm seeing what's happening and you're telling me not to believe the things I'm seeing. And that's quite literally what they're telling us. You know, again, you've heard many, many sort of defenders of Israel say things like, well, the problem is social media. The problem is TikTok. The problem is young people don't really understand the historical context. They don't know what's going on because they're constantly trying to justify this ongoing stream of horror that we are seeing, that we saw for 3 years straight.
It was studying the historical context and analyzing the facts that made me no longer sympathetic to the Zionist position. So it's interesting that anybody would actually say that, because I think the case is just so overwhelmingly in favor of the Palestinians when you just examine this historically. One of the things that you point out in this ceasefire in the media is they'll say things like testing the ceasefire rather than violating the ceasefire. And you show, you know, a snapshot of one of these. I think it's page 173 of my edition here. And I'm convinced we're going to see those headlines and that kind of propaganda one day, if we're old enough and live to it, in Gaza Holocaust museums. We're going to see how, here's how the media used propaganda to lie about what was taking place and really to allow and a genocide. And they're going to give examples like this and many others that you have in the book. I also want to ask you, you mentioned earlier genocide. Look, I think it's just abundantly clear that there's a genocide taking place, but I'll still see every now and then some people in the comment section saying it's not a genocide, it's something lesser than that. Yeah, things that are taking place are not ideal, or maybe they're wrong, but it's not actually a genocide because they're growing in population. The number of Palestinians is increasing, therefore, how could it be a genocide? Could you maybe speak to that?
Well, I think, you know, I am not a genocide expert. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not. But I do listen to them. And I think that's the key difference, right? Because I'm not an expert in many things. And so I listen to the experts and the consensus of those experts. When Roz Siegel, who is an Israeli historian and genocide expert, said, within, I think it was about a week, maybe even less than a week, that this is a textbook case of genocide. He was basing it on his, you know, expertise. He was basing it on his study of genocides in history and understanding that the language that Israeli officials were using matched with the actions that they were taking, made this a textbook case of genocide. So there's all sorts of things that people will say, you know, if they wanted to, this is horrific. I can't believe people say things like this, but it's like, well, if they really wanted to kill everyone, they could do it in a day.
I've heard that many times.
That's not,
I think Mike,
a, that's not what
that.
A genocide is. I mean, if you look up the definition of a genocide, it's the physical destruction, you know, it's the intention to bring about the physical destruction of a group of people. And there are five specific sort of like categories that each one of them, you know, if the transfer of children, destroying their ability to live, mass killing, all of these types of things, all of these categories are part of the definition of genocide. And what's interesting in the case of Gaza is that the reports that have come out from different human rights groups and experts about what is happening actually address multiple of those points. So for instance, Human Rights Watch, when their report on Israel's genocidal acts is based on their targeting or weaponization of water, right? Like targeting desalination plants, targeting water pumps, basically targeting Gaza's access to water, you know, the most vital resource for life, water. So if you're targeting the most vital resource for life, this is considered a genocidal act. Amnesty International, their report looks at things like the use of starvation as a weapon. A UN report, you have multiple UN reports, one that looks at gender-based violence and reproductive violence, another one that looks at the fact that they're deliberately targeting children. All of these are different categories that fit under the definition of genocide. But really, when you look at it, if you look at it it's in its most basic form, imagine, for instance, saying that, you know, sort of engaging in Holocaust denial because the original plan was to expel all Jews from Germany and from Europe. Well, of course, that's still part of a genocidal campaign. You know, it's not, it would be absurd to think about it any other way. But what's the language that Israeli officials use? Well, this is voluntary emigration. Of course, it's not voluntary. If I hold a gun to your head, destroy, kill your family, flatten your house, there's no food, I'm not allowing food to come in, all the farmland is destroyed, and then I say, but I'm allowing you to leave. That's not voluntary. You've destroyed everything and left them no other choice. Making Gaza unlivable was the actual objective and goal. I mean, Netanyahu says this. There's a, in Times of Israel, there's a story from 2024, I believe, 2024 or early 2025, Times of Israel runs a story where Netanyahu says to, I forget who he's saying it to, it might be his own MPs that he's saying this to, but he says, you know, we're destroying their houses so they have nothing to return to. He's saying it explicitly, like, we are destroying their houses. That's deliberate. That's intention, which is key to genocide. The intention to do this is the key. But you have Israeli officials saying we should flatten Gaza. You have Israeli officials saying they're human animals and they should be treated thusly. We're going to block food. We're going to block fuel. They're saying everything outright. And somehow this is being treated like, you know, it's hearsay. Do we really know if it's genocide? Of course, that's the consensus. Do we really know anything then? If you can question, if this is the consensus of the global community, if multiple reports from experts across the board, you have B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization. You have Physicians for Human Rights Israel, another Israeli organization, all saying Israel is committing genocide. If none of these people are to be believed, then you've now, and this is extremely dangerous, you've now sanctioned genocide denial in every case. And I don't engage in genocide denial for the same reason I don't engage in Holocaust denial. It's disgusting. At what point then, if we can just do that, if all the expertise says one thing and we're like, well, I'm going to deny it, then you can deny it in every other situation as well. It sort of renders these institutions, this expertise, it renders the word meaningless. If you're saying it can't be applied here because everyone's not dead. Also, and this can't be emphasized enough, that's not the point of international law. It's not, let's wait till everyone is dead and then we'll say, yes, this was a genocide. The purpose is to prevent genocide. And so when you see it unfolding, you name it and criminalize it so that there is accountability to prevent it from moving further. You're not supposed to wait until a final solution before we actually step in and do something. So that's the other aspect of it that I always find sort of baffling when people say things like, well, they haven't killed everyone. Are you waiting for that? Are we waiting for everyone to be dead or expelled from their land before we finally say, okay, you were right, it was a genocide? I mean, this is not semantics. It's what, if we don't believe the institutions that were created in the wake of a genocide to prevent further genocides, then what is the point of having those institutions?
Yeah, and you know, one is related to the other. I mean, if you're denying this one, like you say, upon what basis do you not deny the Holocaust at that point? And so I have to say, look, I mean, when I was in Israel, they really emphasized the Shoah, the Holocaust, and there's Holocaust Memorial Day and all that, and so they really hammered into you. And I have to say, it's upon that basis, it's from seeing all the horrors of those things, and it's what Israel taught me about the horrors of the Holocaust. It's for that very reason that I condemn what they're doing right now. I can't condemn one but not the other. If you're going to tell me this is horrible, and it is, the Holocaust is terrible because of X, Y, and Z, but then I see Israel committing acts of X, Y, and Z, I have to condemn it by the exact same basis, the same standard that they taught me. I want to ask you...
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, because earlier we talked about like sort of where my interest in, you know, Palestine and in doing this work came from. And I mentioned, you know, I was an undergraduate student. But before that, I mean, if you go through the education system in the United States, you will learn about World War II and the Holocaust over and over again. And that's because it's extremely significant. And it was learning that history and how horrific that history was, that really, to your point, I mean, that's what made me believe in the idea of never again. You know, if you study that, if you read these books over and over again, and it is really drilled, but because it is one of the most horrific things that has happened in human history, then our job is to not allow that to happen again. Not to say that because you were victims, that means you can no, that immunizes you from being victimizers. It's just not the case. And so if we're going to be consistent, then it doesn't matter who it's happening to. It just matters that it's happening.
What I'm very offended by when it comes to misinformation in all of this, and also being very selective in all of it, is, again, it was hammered into me, the Holocaust, which ends roughly, what, 1945? 3 years later, the Zionists go and ethnically cleanse nearly a million Palestinians, committing war crimes, genociding Palestinians 3 years later after the Holocaust, and I didn't hear anything about it. I didn't see movies about it. I didn't read, you know, Palestinian versions of Anne Frank's books and movies about it. None of that. I got to hear all about one side, but all this other stuff that happens just 3 years later and is really ongoing unto the present, you don't really hear a whole lot about. And for me, I'm offended by that, because I think that, wait, if you're going to tell this story, which I think you should, I think we should be aware of what happened in the Holocaust, we also need to say, here's what Israel has been doing. And we need to tell that story, the story of the Palestinians. I have one final question for you. I mean, you're showing how bad this is in the media, how biased it is, how they're manufacturing consent for genocide. Do you think it's going to get any better? The media, do you think things are going to turn around at some point?
It's obviously, it's extremely hard to say. If there are no incentives for it to change, I mean, so far we've seen a pretty consistent pattern. I do think that, you know, I talk about the idea of accountability, and accountability can take different forms. You know, there's sort of legal accountability. There's accountability in terms of, you know, editors that might lose their jobs or journalists that might lose their jobs. I think the idea of media integrity has been lost. You know, it's now, I think that the Gaza genocide is itself a extraordinarily important historical event and something that we should care about because of Palestinians who are being killed. At the same time, there are greater implications to the sort of period that we're living through. And I think that's one of the questions that we have to ask as a society is, in terms of the media, is if there is no accountability, if there is no change, if there is no reform, just like there wasn't after 2003, right? I mean, the media very much repeated what we know as factually today as fabrications and lies to justify atrocities in Iraq, war crimes in Iraq. And we know the consequences of that. We know the, you know, how, and there were people, by the way, in 2003 and 2002 who were telling us, hey, this is going to be really bad. This is going to end really badly. And this country had nothing to do with 9/11, and they do not have weapons of mass destruction. But those voices were not platformed. It was the ones who were goading a war that were platformed. And there were no lessons learned, and there was no accountability. And here we are today, right? There was no change. I will say that the public shift in opinion in the last 3 years is dramatic, and it's real. And it's real because I think the extent of the atrocities that people have seen in the last 3 years is just too much. It is overridden in many ways the propaganda machine that was upholding a specific narrative. And that's why people have lost trust in government. People have lost trust in media institutions. So if they want to gain that trust back, I mean, if they want to uphold the sort of ideals that they claim to represent, then it requires significant change and reform within those major institutions. But whether or not they reform, the world around them is changing. We have more and more independent media. We have more and more, I mean, think about just the number of individual journalists who have Substacks. Think about, you know, new news organizations that have popped up in the last 3 years, like Zateo or Dropsite News. There is a growing body of independent journalism, or more critical journalism, because there's a growing demand for it. And so if the mainstream outlets want to sort of keep up with that, then they will also have to change.
Yeah, it seems like social media is really starting to change some things, at least for certain demographics. Because a lot of people are going to, you know, X to find their information. They're not going to these traditional legacy media outlets. And so I don't know, maybe it's going to be that some of those outlets just end up dying, because who's really going to be reading this 10, 20 years from now? I don't know if the demographic, you know, is still going to be around that reads that kind of stuff, unless, like you say, they change and, you know, keep up with the times.
You know, there's sometimes people actually, I'll get like a comment or a criticism that's like, nobody really reads the New York Times, so why do you bother know, dealing with the New York Times. And I always think, that's not true. People still read the New York Times, you know, like it is still, and part of it, you're absolutely right, part of it is generational. Mm-hmm. The types of media, you know, print media is almost gone,
yeah,
but still out there. And so there's a massive, it's not, you know, 20-year-olds that are using right. print media, but there's still an older generation. Cable news networks, again, there's a generation gap there. So there is definitely a difference, but the same thing to keep in mind is those outlets are all on social media. So they're still part of the story on social media. And actually, that's why the headlines are so important. Mm-hmm. Because again, in the context of social media, people are most of the time not clicking and reading the story. And even if they do, most of them are paywalled. Does everybody have subscriptions to, you know, all of these different outlets? Probably not. So it's not that I think they'll be gone, but how authoritative are they going to be? That's a good question.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, I highly recommend everybody go and get a copy of this, Don't Say Palestine by Asal Rod, our guest here, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes where you can go and purchase a copy. And I also have to ask, number one, put in a plug for your social media, where people can go to learn more about you. And number two, are you working on any other upcoming books as well?
I'm currently not working on any other upcoming books. I might have ideas, but I'm not working on them yet, mostly because, you know, the book is, this one is being published in just a few days.
Right.
And so I'm really focusing on this particular book at the moment. But in terms of social media handles, I'm on Twitter X and Instagram. I still say Twitter, you know, it's hard.
Know,
it's hard to get rid of that in my mind. And on Instagram, at my name, just Asal Rad.
Perfect. I'll put a link to all those in the show notes. And I'd love to have you back on again at any time. You're always welcome to come back on. And thank you so much. This was truly an honor.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and for just a really great conversation.
Thank you.